Hello and welcome to You Really Shouldn't Have, with me, James Warwick. The podcast where each episode I sit down with a different guest as we discuss their career and unwrap a story on the worst gift they've ever been given. Joining me on this episode is Canada's Prince of Piano, Martin Mayer. Martin stopped by to discuss his incredible career in music, full of risk and reward, as well as letting me in on the worst gift he's ever been given. Martin, welcome to the show. It's so great to have you here.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Now, I wanted to go right back to the beginning, because I know you were born in the Czech Republic, and now you're based in Canada. So I wondered what that journey was in terms of you getting from the Czech Republic to Canada. And were you always from a musical family?
Yeah, so the story is interesting. I sort of start with the musical family aspect of it. My grandfather on my father's side played organ in the church, and my grandmother on my father's side played and taught violin. My father was a famous singer in the Czech Republic. And I still get that was back in the sort of, you know, 60s through the 80s before we left. But I still get emails, you know, through my website from fans that are like, I love your music and I love your dad. And could you possibly send me an autographed photo? It's always sort of fun to get those. You know, I'm sure that there's a lot of, you know, celebrity kids that are like, hey, I love your dad. Can you get me an autograph? And I'm like, oh yeah, okay. I know how that feels. The journey from Czech Republic, to Canada went from 86 to 89. We lived in Germany, and then, my parents were deciding that, you know, they wanted to move somewhere else. And the choice was between Australia and Canada, and they had applied at both embassies, and it was the Canadian one that came back first. And so, yeah, been here since 1989, which feels like forever ago.
I won't make you feel too old. That is before I was born, Martin. So not too.
All right. I think I've got another call coming in now. So
no, I was born in 91. So I mean, that's only a couple of years.
Okay,
we're only talking a couple of years.
So we're not even, what, 5 minutes into this, and I already feel like the oldest guy in the room. Oh, wait, I am.
So in terms of the piano, when did your interest first sort of peak in terms of playing piano?
Well, funny you should mention that, James, because they started exactly around the time that you were born. I kid you not. It was, I was in grade, I think grade five. And the, you know, we had music class and everybody sang as a choir and that type of thing. And I was really enamored by the music accompanist's way of playing and the way that she sort of was able to coax this music from this instrument. And after one of the classes, I went to her and I said, you know, this song that we've been singing, could I possibly get the sheet music for it? And she said, well, you know, I can't give it to you because of copyright and all that sort of stuff, which I knew nothing about. And I was like, oh, okay. And later that week, she handed me a manila folder and she's like, you didn't get this from me, but here's the music. And that started my sort of interest in it. My parents saw that I wanted to learn piano and got me started in piano lessons. And yeah, so I started in piano just as you were sort of opening up your eyes to the world for the first time.
And I know, obviously, in terms of when you're learning piano, obviously the classical pieces and the more jazz sort of related stuff is normally the stuff that you will play as you're beginning to learn, those sort of classic pieces. But did you ever sort of venture into some more contemporary stuff, or was your interest always sort of in the more classical part of the spectrum?
Well, I would say that I'm classically trained. I don't consider myself a classical pianist. What's really great is that I have the classical background so that I can get into some of the more advanced, you know, neoclassical type of stuff. But I started with the classical, and then at some point I went, you know, this isn't for me. I can't see myself as, you know, the guy in the tux with the orchestra playing, you know, Beethoven or Brahms or anything like that. Not to say that there's anything wrong with that, but it just wasn't for me. I was listening to David Foster, John Williams, Elton John, you know, Yanni, John Tesh, and those types of guys, and I went, this is my style of music. And so it was important to have that classical training background because it gave me the technique to be able to go, yeah, I can play some of this stuff. It was the more difficult part was was learning the jazz stuff and learning some of those, you know, some of those chord structures and the sounds, you know, that Herbie Hancock and Chick Corea and those sort of guys made famous.
You went through the classical training. So
yep.
I'm assuming there was always that ambition to work within music. That was always the goal.
I think there was, I don't know that there was an ambition to work in music as much as there was an ambition to play and to be artistic. I don't think I really set out to say I'm going to study piano and I'm going to play Carnegie Hall by the time I'm 18 and, you know, do international tours and that type of thing. It started with, you know, music in school, and then it developed into a love for the piano, which now is it's actually this year I'm celebrating 30 years of playing the piano.
Wow. Incredible. Now, your career really sort of took off after a rather big risk, shall we say, which I'm building towards the risk, and I'll let you tell the story. But before we get to that point, what was sort of your early exposure? I guess once your training was done, what was sort of that early career looking like before you took the big jump, shall we say?
I think my first sort of venture in terms of playing live in front of people was playing in my dad's dance band. Here in Canada, you know, five-piece group that played on weekends, you know, weddings, anniversaries, you know, the Legions and that type of thing. So that got my start in terms of being comfortable in terms of playing live in front of people and playing, you know, covers and that type of thing. So I had a lot of experience in terms of playing in front of people before I actually got onto a professional concert stage. There was an interesting sort of period where I started experimenting with writing and composing and, you know, my own sort of pieces. And that got me my first commercial when I was 16, which is crazy to think about, you know, that they would take music written and produced by a 16-year-old composer. Yeah. But it went on to the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, which is, you know, our sort of equivalent to your BBC. And it was really cool, and sort of that was the next thing that sort of, you know, lit more of that fuse that went, hey, this is kind of cool. I like the marriage of my music with picture, you know, maybe I can explore that a bit further. But I didn't explore that part as much as I did, you know, writing more music and just writing more and more and more.
So I mentioned the risk, and we'll get there. And I'll let you, I'll let you tell the story. I won't spoil anything. It's your story.
You can if you want to. It's your show. You can do whatever you like.
That's very kind of you. But what was the journey in terms of getting to that point where you thought, I've got to take out this rather large loan to see whether or not the project I have in mind is going to work or not?
Yeah. Well, so after writing all that music, I recorded a demo. You know, sent it around to radio stations, and, you know, back in the day of CDs and, you know, CD labels and CD burners and all that sort of stuff. You know, now everything is digital, you know. Yeah. You can send everything. Like last year we did a new version of Carol of the Bells that went international, and we used this radio promotion company here in Vancouver, and it just went everywhere. Before that, you know, you needed to do that with CDs. But I wrote all that music and then recorded this demo, and I was like, okay, so I'm not really getting anywhere with this. I need to find some kind of, you know, way to throw a rock into the pond that is going to have some kind of ripple effect in Canada. Because in Canada, piano isn't as revered as guitar is, right? People will more likely see a country band or a rock concert or, you know, a pop concert rather than necessarily a jazz concert or even classical music. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's just, you know, everywhere is different tastes. And as I've discovered, you know, Asia and Europe are far more leaned towards the piano than they are here in North America. So at one point I was reading an article, I think it was in either Keyboard or Billboard magazine, and it said, if you're sitting on the couch waiting for a record company to come and find you, you're going to be an old man with a dog and little bits of Cheerios on the floor before anybody does. You need to take some kind of, you need to take some kind of action. And around that time, you know, PBS here in North America was running Yanni Live at the Acropolis, and then the following year they had John Tesh Live at Red Rocks. And when I saw those two specials, I went, that's my style of music, and this is really cool in terms of what these people are doing. I need to do something like this, you know, obviously within my reach of scope, because both of those were backed by people that believed in, you know, who they were. Yanni's project was funded by Linda Evans and, you know, her connection with the television and acting world. And, you know, John Tesh was a well-known name, in the Entertainment Tonight business, you know, and his wife, Connie Selica, famous actress. So people knew who those people were. Right.
Absolutely.
And so for them to go and say, yeah, I'm going to go and do this big project, was something that they were able to do. For me it was a little bit more tricky than that.
So then you got to planning this special. So I'm interested to know the process you went through in terms of putting it together.
The process that I went through was doing it all wrong and hoping that it was going to succeed. I mean, I was 18 at the time, trying to do what, you know, people in their early 40s with millions of dollars were trying to do for, you know, broadcast television. I was just trying to mount my debut concert. I was in university at the time, so I, you know, hired my bandmates and hired a 20-piece orchestra and a film crew and an audio recording crew. And I went to the bank and I said, I'm trying to do this debut concert to start my career. And the whole notion of it is that it's going to be the rock that you throw into the pond that is going to make a ripple effect within North America and get me started. They're like, how much do you need for it? And I said, well, $35,000. And they said, okay, how much money are you making right now? And I said, about $350. And they said, $350 what? $350, $3.50. Said $350, and I said, per week? And I said, no, per year.
Shit.
And they said, oh, well, that's not going to work. I mean, I was, you know, I was in university. I was working weekends in my dad's band and, you know, paying for cell phones and that type of thing. But I didn't have this sort of wherewithal to put any money aside. So they said, okay, we like your plan and we want to back you on this, but you need to have a parent co-sign in order to get the loan.
Oh, wow.
So my mom co-signed the loan. I did the show. It ended up being standing room only. The live recording was a lot of work to, you know, put together in the studio, but it ended up being my first official album and was nominated for an outstanding instrumental album at the Regional Music Awards. And that was what sort of got me started. What was interesting about it, and it sort of, I'm thinking, leads into your next question, but that ripple that I wanted to create in North America, I threw the rock with this debut concert, and it had a ripple effect, but not where I expected it to.
No, not at all, because I should have introduced you at the start as the Prince of Piano, because of course, that is how you are called.
Oh, go on.
Yeah, if you have to.
Yeah, if you have to, I'll just sit here and drink tea while you do and in rest on my laurels.
Of course, you have been coined by the Chinese press as the Prince of Piano. So I'm assuming China was way out of your thoughts when you first threw that rock into the ocean.
Oh, totally. There was no sense. I mean, if somebody had come and said to me, look, if you do this concert, it's going to be successful. You know, you're going to get your first record. It's going to be nominated for an award. And by the way, you know, you're going to get this amazing tour out of it. I would have said, that's crazy. I'm not even aiming that high. But what was interesting is that once the album was done, you know, I threw it up on my website, and one day I just got this random email that sort of read like one of those Dear Beneficiary spam emails. And I still have it because it's not something that I would ever let go. But I remember reading it, and it was so specific in terms of who these people were and the company that they were from and what they were doing, what they were looking for. And they basically said that they had listened to my music, they liked what they heard, and they wanted to invite me on a 6-week, 16-city concert tour of China. And I didn't know what to think of it at the time, so I forwarded it to my manager, and I said, what do you think of this? He said, well, let's respond and see what happens. And we did, and we went back and forth and, you know, talked about contracts and all this sort of stuff. And then they said, we want to come to Canada and see Martin perform in concert before we sign off on this. And I went, if they come here to see a show and they sign the contract, I'm committed to this. There's absolutely no there's no reason that I wouldn't do it. So they came, I did the show, we signed the contracts, and next thing I know, we're getting on a plane, you know, to do this tour. And James, it was absolutely insane. I mean, I'd never been anywhere except for here, and having done that one show, and all of a sudden I was in a foreign country with, paparazzi waiting for me at the airport, and being mobbed for autographs and police escorts and all of this sort of stuff. It was just an incredible wild ride. And so when I think of that risk that I took, I pointed my direction this way, and life said, well, we're going to adjust that a little bit to give you something a little bit more interesting. And then, you know, I looked at that email and I could have easily deleted it.
Oh, for sure.
And, you know, one of these days it'll make for a great story of the one email that changed my life, because, if I hadn't, I don't know if my life would have turned out the same.
It's really interesting, isn't it? You sort of think, oh, what if I hadn't have done that?
Where would
you be now? But yeah. I was interested in terms of China about the sort of difference of culture, because I guess it must have been a bit of a culture shock to suddenly get dropped into a place you'd never been before, somewhere that you didn't realize, you know, you had any following within.
Yeah.
You know, you got all those paparazzi people wanting the autographs. What was it like for you in terms of when you got there to China, just before that sort of the first concert? Did you sort of think, This is all a dream, or this can't be true?
I wasn't thinking of it in that respect. And the reason for that is because I was immensely overworked, underslept, in getting prepped for the tour. And the reason for that is because we started rehearsing the night before 9/11. Oh. And the evening of that terrible day, everybody in the band came, handed their contracts back, and said, you know, I'm not going anywhere.
Oh, for sure, yeah.
You know, nobody wanted to fly a plane regionally, let alone across, you know, the ocean to a different country. So I had a lot of work to do to convince the band to say, look, if it's not going to be safe to fly later, we won't go. But for now, I've committed to this, and, you know, we have to keep going. And so it was a brutal amount of work to keep this going and try to keep the energy in the music when people's spirits were so zapped, because nobody knew what was coming next, right? And I had the weight of this tour on my shoulders, while also trying to make sure that everybody in my band was okay. And so when we got there, I was probably more exhausted at the beginning of the tour than I was at the end of it, because I ended up, you know, feeding off the energy from the audiences that were there to see me. And so that first concert was actually was filmed for TV. And so, you know, in addition to no pressure on the first show, you know, we're going to drop you into this brand new country in terms of brand new audiences and all this sort of stuff. And, you know, at the same time, it's going to be filmed for television. So the first show was just kind of felt like a blur. But the rest of it, once it sort of picked up, you know, steam and I found my footing, it was just it wasn't so much culture shock as it was just shock in general. I mean, people lining up for an hour and a half to, you know, get an autograph with me. You know, people at the front desk of a hotel selling out my room information, having, you know, people knock at my door at 2 o'clock in the morning wanting an autograph. It was just so bizarre, and the amount of work that they had done to promote me and this tour was incredible. I mean, it always has been. And so it's very different, you know, as an experience there, even, you know, to this day.
What do you feel is sort of your most memorable moment? If you can look back on your career and all of the concerts you've done, what do you think is the most memorable one for you?
That's a good question. I mean, there's so many of them. I love that look on people's faces when, that's a really great question, James. No way to stump your guest, you know. I would say so I'm going to pick two. The first one is when I've gone to China and I've played my music, but then I will go and take something that is sort of you know, a folklore type tune of theirs, and rearrange it in, you know, sort of North American style, and play it for them, because it goes from an audience that is, you know, very excited but somewhat subdued, to all of a sudden people have that look on their face of like, he's playing our song. How does he know that song? You know, we used to sing this in school and grandma taught me that, and you know, that type of thing. It's when you sort of connect with an audience that way, it completely changes the shift of how the rest of the show goes. And in that moment, and they go from being an audience to feeling like friends of yours that are sitting, because they cheer you on, they want the best for you. And so that, in terms of you know, live performance, is, I would say, is my most favorite. The other one that also comes to mind is something that happened last year, just as we were getting locked down during the pandemic, and I was doing a couple of these, you know, online concerts, which were very different from the usual show, because, you know, you're used to feedback from an audience, right? And clapping and all that sort of stuff. And I would finish the song and all of a sudden there'd be nothing, you know. You could see on the screen that people were watching with the number counts and whatnot, and they would leave little emojis and whatnot, but it wasn't the same. But what was really cool is that one day after one of these concerts, this lady recognized me at the local grocery store, and she says, I want to come up and I want to hug you and I want to thank you, but I can't. So I will just tell you what your music means to me. Yesterday, my brother passed away in the morning, and I was completely inconsolable. And in the afternoon, I found your concert online, and it gave me the healing and the soothing that I needed to feel like everything was going to be okay. So thank you for that. Wow. And it's difficult not to manifest tears when sharing that story, because it's just completely so profound that, you know, for me, any time that I've done music, it has always, always, always been about the art first. And to know that, you know, somebody could be touched like that during a difficult day is incredible. So I would say those are my two favorite memories.
That's really powerful. I mean, for her to first of all recognize you in the grocery store and think, oh my God, it's the guy. And then for her to be touched in that way by your music, that's really something that really must stick with you.
Hey, it's the guy with the bald head. It must be you.
I wanted to touch back on a point you made just now about taking the sort of classic Chinese songs and rearranging them. When you're picking those sort of folklore songs, if you like, if we can call them that, are you consulting with anyone else about which ones are best to pick and which ones are best to rearrange at all? As in, which ones are more popular?
Yeah, totally. I mean, my agents are really good in terms of knowing, you know, what is the latest it thing. If we're going into, you know, if we're going into the sort of modern stuff of what's been on the radio in the past 20 years. But if we're digging back into what I like to sort of call those cultural gems, then yeah, absolutely. It's not something that I have enough knowledge about to be able to do myself. You know, I get a sense now in terms of when I listen to a melody or something like that, it's like, yeah, this one's gonna work. And they'll send me, you know, 10 or 15 songs, and they'll recommend, you know, some, but they'll let me pick the ones that I want to do. It's always fun to sort of take something and just, you know, do it a little bit differently, even if it goes from a song that is full production to then, you know, just taking it for me to play at the piano. It's a fun experience, and I always enjoy that.
Now, the last sort of 18 months have been strange for everybody, and you've already touched on the online concerts, and I'm assuming you had a lot of stuff planned, sort of, you know, early 2020 that got completely called off. So what are you hoping to do now that we're starting to unlock again, and what are you working on currently?
Yeah, the 18 months was, for lack of a better phrase, it was challenging in the sense that I went from the most recent 20-city concert tour that I had just finished to creating this momentum path that was going to see me go to Midem in France, which is the big music conference, and then have a performance in France, and then in Italy, and then going back to China in the fall. That got all erased. And, you know, it went from a very busy year to all of a sudden, like, you know, what am I supposed to do with all of this time? I did write new music. I went and recorded an album that is in the process of being sort of finalized for release and a larger project that goes along with that. The tricky part about that is that, you know, when I've released music before, it's usually tied to some kind of a tour or a concert, something like that, so that you can introduce it, and so that people that go to the show can buy, you know, either the CD or have me sign it or something like that. But now it's, you know, it's challenging to say, yeah, we're going to do a tour next fall. And even, you know, my China agents and I have been talking about this since March of this year, because it takes a long time to put a 20 city tour together, the logistics and all that sort of stuff. And that's just their part, you know. For me, then it comes to, you know, creating the show. And so, you know, I have this project and it's pretty much ready to go, but I'm not sure where I can assign the sort of launch of it, because if I do it too soon and then we have a tour, people are going to be like, oh, well, we want new music for that. Well, this music is new. It was released last year. Yeah, but, you know, the record's already a year old, right? I've never really understood that about in our music industry, where people say, like, well, your record is 2 years old. I'm not sure if it'll play on radio. What are you talking about? They're playing Elton John's records from like 50 years ago. What's the difference? It doesn't matter whether it was made yesterday or 5 years ago in my view, but there's something about a potential expiration date. Once it gets into the system, then it can be played until, you know, forever. But yeah, so I'm right now trying to figure out the timing of when to get this going.
I just sort of had a thought, but because you mentioned about coming off the back of that 20 city tour just before everything started. I'm assuming that was in China. And obviously,
yes,
China is where the COVID-19 outbreak started. So were you there when it was starting to break out there before maybe the rest of us had heard about it?
No, I was there September 2019. And what was really sort of interesting is that when I first heard about this happening, you know, it was coming out of Wuhan and they were showing the pictures of, you know, the deserted streets and, you know, this big massive thoroughfare with this one lonely cyclist. And I remember looking at it and going, oh my gosh, this has to be something else, because we had traveled through there. We had traveled through that airport and had gone through that exact same road. And that place is packed with traffic. I mean, you know, it's one of the big travel hubs in that country. And so when they were showing the fact that, you know, there wasn't any, like, not a single soul on that street, I went, okay, this is something else. And so it was really weird for me to see this, because it was like driving from, you know, your friend's place, and in the rearview mirror, you're just seeing the house start to catch fire, right? And you go like, you know, I was just there. And so the whole thing was just kind of like a, you know, Twilight Zone type of experience.
Oh my God! Martin, we've reached a part of the show where I have to ask you, what is the worst gift you've ever been given?
Well, I have two, and you know, we sort of talked about it at the beginning of the show, where I said I'm not sure which one is the best.
Both. We'll have them both.
Okay. Well, so which one to pick first? I would say one of the worst gifts that I've ever gotten was from an ex at a milestone birthday. It was a it was a half dead rose bush.
What?
Yeah, it was a half dead rose bush that was given to me at the birthday, and then that ex promptly passed out at the dinner table in front of me and my friends.
Oh wow.
And so, you know, that's one of the reasons that person shall be called an ex for sure. The rest of my life. The other one that really comes to mind is that we have a group of friends that we get together with every Christmas. And there's this really great tradition that we've had for the past 15 years or so, that we do like a, not like a secret Santa, but like a gift exchange, sort of like, you know, we're, you know, put together a list of some of the things that you might like, you know, whatever it is. And people will go and choose what they want to get for you. And sometimes, you know, if it's a box of chocolates, like I'm a huge Ferrero Rocher and Nutella type of guy. So the anytime that somebody gives me more of those, the better. So we would all have these lists and they'd be shared. And one of the friends came and said to me, so I saw your list and, you know, it's really cool. Is there anything else that you might want? And I just kind of thought about it and texted back in. And she said, okay, so what about, you know, anything else? And I'm like, this list is like 12 things long already. You know, how much more do you want? And so I thought about for a couple more things. And then a couple of days later, she comes back and she says, okay, cool. Anything else that you can think of? And I'm going like, no, I mean, now we're at like, you know, 20 things. I'm sure there's something from here that you can pick, right? And, you know, it had gotten into like ridiculous things. I thought to myself, okay, well, how about a, you know, a really nice expensive bottle of wine and see, you know, if she would go for it. And so get to this party. And people are passing stuff around and, you know, you opening things and it's just like, oh, yeah, this is really cool and all this sort of stuff. And the important part of the story of why this collates is that when I asked when she wrote on her list that she wanted bedding, I said, well, OK, that's not very specific. Do you have anything in particular in mind? Mm. I was not prepared for what I received next, which was basically a color swatch that said, I want bedding in basically this exact color, you know, 700 thread count, you know, it has to be this kind of fabric, and it has to be made of, you know, natural materials and all this sort of stuff. Like, it was just one thing that all of a sudden became like this requirement.
Very specific item.
Yeah. And it's not like you can just go to any department store and go, yeah, I'm just going to get you blue bedding. It had to be, you know, Moroccan blue with 700 thread count and had to be made from this, this, and that. It took me maybe 8 trips to different shopping centers and stores and trying to look online before I was able to find the one.
You're a good guy,
and
I was like, you're a good guy.
Yeah.
I'd have given up. You're
a good guy. Yeah, I would have been like, this is blue. This is what you get. You said bedding. I should have just gone with bedding and not asked the damn question. So 8 trips and all that sort of stuff. And then the back and forth between asking, you know, what more I wanted because the list of 12 items in the beginning wasn't enough. So we get to the night and everybody's opening up presents. And all of a sudden I get handed one from her. And it's this little cute little box. And I think to myself, oh, I wonder what this is. You know, it has to be something really exciting, right? I went all of this time, I spent 8, you know, went to 8 different shopping centers and I open up this box and I look at it and it's a $10 gift card to Best Buy.
No.
Yep. And I looked at it and I went, okay, I'm in a room of like 15 other people that are watching my reaction. How do you, like, you know, in my head, I'm thinking, what? I went to 8 different shopping centers looking for Moroccan bloody blue, you know, bedding and 750 thread count, and I got a $10 Best Buy gift card out of it.
Did you make it like it was a great thing in front of all the people?
I don't remember what I did. I just, I think I just kind of went like, cool, thanks, you know. I'll deal with the anger and resentment and rage on the drive home, you know, screaming in the car and people driving by going like, what is his problem? But the funny part about it is that a couple of days later, I got a text and she said, so did you spend your gift card yet? And I said, no, I'm waiting for the $6.99 sale. Because there's, you know, if you've ever gone to Best Buy, you can't buy a cable for $10. No. You can't buy, there isn't anything, even the, you know, the $9.99 movie that you can get, you know, plus tax is still on top
still
of that.
So 10, yeah. Wrapping up, I have a couple of questions that I ask everybody that comes onto the show. So if you could go back to your childhood and rescue a gift that you don't have now, what would you go back and rescue?
The first piano my parents bought me.
Nice.
It was, that was really cool coming home. one day, and there was a truck parked outside that said something music on it, and I didn't think anything of it. And then went upstairs to my room, and there was a digital piano there. Wow. And it was my first piano. It was one that was, you know, that I trained on. It was one that I played, you know, my first number of gigs on. It was ridiculously heavy, because it was, you know, it was the early 90s, you know, and it was also intended to be a digital piano that stayed at home. But I would go and get that back. Yeah.
And if you could go back to the beginning of your career and give yourself a gift to help you get where you are now, what gift would you give yourself?
Here's the tricky part about answering that. I believe that through the various risks and successes and failures and pains and everything like that, all of the dots that were connected and the ones that were missed and the ones that were misled and all that sort of stuff, have shaped who I am, have shaped my music and how I connect with people. I think if I went back and said, you know, I'm going to give myself $250,000 to do this first concert, it wouldn't have been as humbling of an experience. And certainly, you know, people coming and saying, yeah, we want you to do a concert tour, wouldn't have felt the same way. I honestly don't know what I would give myself, except maybe more patience, or maybe more. I'm just trying to think. There isn't really anything materialistic that comes to mind.
I was going to say it doesn't necessarily have to be physical. A lot of people have gone back and given themselves advice previously. Mm.
I think I would have given myself maybe a bit more courage. Mm-hmm. I think there's things that I probably could have done better or differently. I think, you know, in some of my earlier years, I was working with people that were seeing where I was going and were coming along for the ride for their own intentions instead of bettering mine. And that's difficult when those people are, you know, your management or recording engineers and those type of people. So maybe, you know, sort of more insight or something like that. But again, you know, those experiences have made me aware of the sort of types of things that when I have conversations with people now, I didn't have that gut instinct back then to know what was right and what wasn't. And it wasn't to my benefit, but I learned from the lesson. So I would say, you know, I would then have to, I guess, select courage and see if that would get me on a better path. But I think maybe it would get me, I think it would still get me here. Gee, I don't know. That's so tough. Because I truly believe that, you know, with where I am and where I've gotten is the connection of those various dots and points and some of those ones.
No, I completely appreciate that. I can appreciate that because life is a journey, right? And you're always, I'm always a believer that you're always learning. So I can completely resonate with that when you're saying, well, all these things that I've done, I've learned from it and I wouldn't change any of it because had that not happened, I wouldn't have learned this. And from not learning that, I wouldn't have done that. So perhaps you can be the first guest ever, Martin, to not give yourself a gift at all.
Okay. I think maybe what I would give myself as a gift today is going back to the start of this podcast and asking how old you were first. That way I wouldn't feel like the oldest guy in the room. Maybe that's what I need to do going forward on these types of programs, is finding out if I'm the oldest guy in the room, and if I'm not, great, you know.
Fantastic. Martin, where can people find out more about you and what you do?
MartinMayerMusic.com is the best way to find me. Martin Mayer, M-A-Y-E-R, music.com. On Instagram and Facebook at I Am Martin Mayer.
Fantastic. Martin, it's been great chatting with you. Thanks so much for stopping by.
James, pleasure. Hope to do it again soon.
Thanks again for listening to this episode of You Really Shouldn't Have. Be sure to subscribe to us on your chosen podcast service to make sure you never miss another episode. You can find us on both Twitter and Instagram at Bad Gifts Pod, as well as online at badgiftspod.com.